You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network. I'm Tracy Ross.
And I'm Rebecca Vallis, calling in from not the studio.
From an undisclosed location.
We are the hardest working women in the show business that has to do with the anti-poverty movement, Tracy. We are doing an episode even on July 4th week when no one else is.
And you made that a very narrow threshold. We're the most successful women co-hosts show about poverty with hosts named Rebecca and Tracy.
Well, and all of that was true.
And I have to tip my hat to you in particular because you are currently on vacation. I've not yet left yet, but I am impressed by your ability to always work.
You're impressed or you're scared. We don't
a little
know,
bit of both. A little bit of both. So
fair enough.
We're gonna kick this episode off like we do most weeks with the number of the week, and I'm gonna throw you a softball one since you know what this episode's about. The number of the week is 1964.
Well, I have to say, I appreciate you giving me a softball because my brain is not fully functioning in work mode this week. So could it have something to do with civil rights?
Ding, ding, ding. You got it.
What do I win?
So you get to keep participating on this show as a co-host.
Oh, good.
So 1964 is when we saw passage of the Civil Rights Act on this very day 51 years ago. And this is, I think, a particularly important anniversary for us to commemorate because the civil rights movement was both about social justice and economic justice. And, you know, it's about ensuring that everyone has the right as well as the means to be successful in this country. And I just want to read a quote from Martin Luther King that really summarizes that. What does it profit a man to be able to eat at an integrated lunch counter if he doesn't earn enough money to buy a hamburger?
Well said.
And I think that this is in line with some recent policies we've seen. The Department of Labor just proposed raising the overtime threshold from $23,600 a year to $50,440, which some are calling the middle class minimum wage. And under this new salary threshold, employers would either have to pay overtime and a half for extra hours worked, or they would have to hire more workers at the standard rate to fill in those unpaid hours. So either way, it's promoting work and promoting fair pay. And these are the sorts of, I think, promises that the civil rights movement wanted to see and that have yet to be fulfilled. So this is some progress that we're seeing today.
Yeah, I think that actually feeds really well with a lot of conversations that we're going to have in this episode, given that, you know, as much as the Civil Rights Act is a product of the 1960s, it really isn't, or I should say the civil rights movement really isn't in our rearview mirror. We're really still fighting on a lot of fronts to see the full realization of a lot of what people have been fighting for many decades.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm excited that in this episode, I get to speak with Michelle Jawando, who's vice president for legal progress here at CAP. And, you know, she and I go through some of the Supreme Court cases that we recently saw, which were huge civil rights wins in terms of housing, in terms of the LGBT movement. But also, you know, the recent events in Charleston, South Carolina, remind us that there's a lot of work that remains, as you were just saying. And she provides some great insights on those issues.
Well, and I can't say that either of us climbed any flagpoles this week, but I also will speak with Rebecca Coakley, who is the executive director of the National Council on Disability. And we talk about sort of how the disability rights movement and the continuing fight for inclusion, both socially and economically, of people with disabilities in American society fits in with the civil rights movement and actually shares a lot of the same roots. And then I also have a conversation with Katie Klobusik. She is a reproductive justice activist and also someone I've followed for a long time on Twitter and I'm a huge fan of. She has a new piece actually this week in RH Reality Check. The subject of that piece and the subject of our conversation is very much the link between poverty and the fight for economic justice and reproductive justice.
Well, I'm excited about this episode. I think we really highlight the fact that the civil rights movement is a broad movement that includes lots of intersecting issues, and we've got a great lineup for you all.
Well, I'm excited too, and that's why I called in.
Thanks for calling in, Rebecca. You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network. I'm Tracy Ross. On today's show, we're commemorating the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. I'm joined in the studio by Michelle Jawando, Vice President for Legal Progress here at the Center for American Progress. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So we're marking over 50 years of the Civil Rights Act, and obviously we've made a lot of progress. People even point to the fact that we have an African-American president as a symbol of that progress. But, you know, from thinking about a legal perspective, a social perspective, how do you think our country is doing in terms of the rights of African Americans?
So first off, I'm so excited to be here in the great work and conversation that Talk Poverty Radio is doing on the questions and the issues of the day. As we think about kind of like these ideas about race and racial progress, I think we should, without question, recognize that we're in a special moment in time in history. With the election twice now, we've been able to elect President Barack Obama, and that was significant. But in some ways, the symbolism of Barack Obama and what he has meant for this country doesn't always connect to the lived realities for people of color, and I think African Americans. And there are still basic issues of fairness that come into play. So, for example, last week we were so excited that the Supreme Court held 5-4, which is a very narrow win, that disparate impact, which is this kind of idea that some things don't have to be overt discrimination, but they can be subtle and they can still have the effects of perpetuating discrimination. And the Supreme Court found that kind of an analysis that looks at that kind of subtle adverse impact is constitutional. Now, we passed that bill in 1968, 4 years after the anniversary that we're commemorating today. But the fact that 45 years later, we still were fighting to make sure that the Supreme Court did the right thing. And we had amicus briefs from people from all across the country kind of writing in about why this is important, not just for people of color, but for women who were victims of domestic abuse or for families with children who were subjected to really tight housing regulations. So the fact that we are constantly in this push and pull about our kind of rights and equality is something that I think we as a country have always dealt with, and it's a challenge that persists. But we're headed in the right direction.
And were you at all surprised by the outcome of that case? Because we saw last year that the Supreme Court delivered a blow to voting rights. So obviously there's been a split in terms of what the justices themselves think is reasonable protections for people.
So I will tell you, you know, I'm a progressive, so I have to be an optimist, like kind of by default. That's the only way you can do this work. However, when you look at just the law, disparate impact, fair housing, 45 years of precedent, we were concerned the Supreme Court even took this case in the first place. But if you just look at a naked explanation of a reading of the law, the decision that came down was the right one. What really is disconcerting is the fact that it was such a narrow win, that it was a 5-4 decision as opposed to 9-0, which it really should have been when you're looking at something like this. Because the reality is the lives that certain people in this country live is very different from others. And housing, without question, is one of those fault lines in this country. We know, depending on where your zip code is in this country, your life outcomes are different, your educational opportunities are different, your health, your age of mortality, all of that matters depending on where you live, which is why this was such a significant case. And so we know that the court often wrestles with issues about race and racism. There's a great dissent from Justice Sonia Sotomayor where she basically pushes the majority in a separate opinion, not this one, and really says how out of step with reality they are when it comes to the concept of race and the reality of lives lived for people of color. So these are hard questions, not just for the Supreme Court justice, justices, but for us all.
And one other civil rights win that we saw last week was on marriage equality. So it was something that the Supreme Court was actually in step with reality, luckily. Do you think that this win will pave the way for greater protections for LGBT people?
Well, I am fingers crossed and I'm hoping so. You know, the reality is what we saw last week was an affirmation of equal protection under the law, that you couldn't pick and choose kind of what we think about our the notion and the institution of marriage. But what we also recognize is that you can be married on Saturday and you can be fired from your job on Monday. And so there has to continually be this kind of constant push towards bringing in anti-discrimination laws. And that's for everybody, right? When we think about how we protect the least of these, how we think about everyone in this kind of global community, we have to think about how do we protect people in society? And so the work there, particularly for the LGBTQ community, is not at all finished. And there's work left to be done.
And so the past 2 weeks, we've seen a lot of, I think, major changes going on. It's been an exhausting, I think, couple weeks for people that are paying attention to social justice issues. And we know that there was a shooting at the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, where 9 people were killed. And in the wake of that, there's been a renewed call to remove the Confederate flag from South Carolina's state capitol and in other government facilities across the country. It seems almost absurd that we're still debating the civil war and the sides of it. Could you explain what it means to you to witness renewed call for its removal?
So the emotion that I think I've had for the past few weeks has been raw. I am a child of the Black Church, of the AME Church. My mother is an AME reverend. My father is an AME deacon. I was a lay youth minister and am still very active in my church. I'm actually speaking on a panel this evening at my church talking about social justice and race and the Black Church and our role. I've been to Mother Emmanuel. So pieces here just really hit me personally. And as I was kind of reeling with that, we also had kind of these wins at the Supreme Court for the work that I do every day. And it was so almost quintessentially American in some ways that you dealt with this kind of tragedy. We're still looking at issues on the fault lines of race and racism and how hate and evil manifests itself. And at the same time, we were celebrating the fact that now millions of people will have access to health care that they did not have before the presidency of Barack Obama, right? So it's this constant push and pull. I think for anyone kind of engaged in this work, we always have to take some perspective. You know, there were generations of slaves who were born into slavery, who hoped for freedom, and that never came to pass. But they never left the ideal of what freedom could look like. And so when I kind of put myself in their place versus where I am, without question, there's been success and we've made progress. But I often think that because so much of the conversation lately tends to focus on symbols or kind of outside issues, so gun violence in our community, mental illness, how we think about the symbolism of the Confederate flag are all real issues. We should not diminish any of them. They have resonance and they mean something in our community. But what I also want to continually bring people back to is how do we unpack the stereotypes behind and the kind of implicit bias behind these symbols, behind these issues that really spur certain actions either way. Because it's when we get to start to recognize the humanity of each other, I think that's when we see kind of progress of the scale that I'm hoping that we can push each other to see.
And President Obama spoke, I think, at length on a variety of those issues in his eulogy for Reverend Clementa Pinckney last week. And, you know, I'm glad that you mentioned your involvement in the church. You know, I was not raised in the African-American church, but I think it's hard to be Black in the U.S. and not be brought to at least some of it at a Black church at some point in your life. And so for me, witnessing the Black president standing on the stage, essentially in the position of a reverend, mm-hmm. delivering mm-hmm. words that were meant for that congregation and allowed to be witnessed by the rest of the country was very powerful to me. He was not speaking to his voters necessarily or, you know, constituents. He was speaking to that church. And it moved me deeply. And as someone who's actually, you know, raised in the AME church, what do you think the significance or his eulogy was?
So, you know, it was such a powerful moment. I mean, I was literally boo-hooing. There was a collective of my colleagues and I, we kind of had a moment of just both joy as well as healing. I think for anyone looking at that speech, what you saw is, for so many of us, it's like, how do you reconcile kind of rage and anger and hate and evil with at the same time kind of this optimism and joy and this belief of forgiveness and the belief that we are doing better and there are things that we are doing that we've never even imagined and have yet to come. And so reconciling those emotions sometimes are difficult, but the way that the president so eloquently did it, it reminded me why I'm so proud to kind of live in this day and age, why while he is the president, to be able to have someone who can kind of live in both worlds and be able to share that in such a naked, honest way to connect with so many people. I think it doesn't matter kind of what, if you're religious or non-religious, if you're atheist or agnostic, you could not help but be moved by watching that speech because it came from such a real place for this president. And it was also a call to action as well. You know, it was healing, but at the same time, he talked about implicit bias where we call Johnny back and not Jamal. And we talked about the fact that we have to deal with the issue of mass gun violence in this country that no other country has to deal with, these kind of mass shootings. So it wasn't this, you know, just all hope and optimism. It was really pushing us at a country so that we could have more of this perfect union. It was really an amazing moment.
And to that point, I wanted to quote a bit of it. He said, "None of us can or should expect a transformation in race relations overnight. Every time something like this happens, somebody says we have to have a conversation about race. We talk a lot about race. There's no shortcut. We don't need more talk." So, like you said, it was a call to action. What are some of the things that you think that this administration can do now? There's not, you know, much time left in his term, but what do you think that this has opened the door for Obama doing?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things we saw is he is not a lame duck. even today, there's an announcement of how we can change kind of overtime rules and pay in this country. That's significant because that's going to help everybody, but it's going to disproportionately help communities of color. When you think about some of the work that he's been pushing and kind of championing, whether it's thinking about kind of banning the box for those returning citizens coming out of the criminal justice system, or even his work on paid leave and paid sick days, those are all affecting everyone, but it again disproportionately affects communities of color. So I think, and even just his work on the MBK and the Women of Girls Council. I mean,
MBK meaning My Brother's Keeper.
Correct. Yes. And being able to talk about these issues and pushing back against the kind of narrative and the stereotypes when we think about communities of color, that in of itself has been instrumental in changing the narrative and changing the way that we think about each other.
And obviously, you know, we're commemorating the anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, and we know that the civil rights movement was really spurred by the people. So it's not just about what the government can do. And we've seen a lot of conversations about police brutality. The movement that's got a lot of momentum behind it is the Black Lives Matter movement, which I think is a grassroots action and a social media call to action. Some people express concerns that youth-led efforts like Black Lives Matter are inhibited by the lack of a clear leader. But leaders within these movements would say that they're not leaderless, they're leaderful. How do you think the Black Lives Matter movement has been effective, or how could it be more effective?
So, you know, one thing that I have often heard is this a new civil rights movement? And I would say, no, it's a continuation. People didn't leave after Dr. King passed away. right? The movement continued, and there were matriarchs and patriarchs of the movement who have continued, institutions that, whether or not people can differ about how their effectiveness, but institutions like NAACP or NAACP LDF and the National Urban League and the National Action Network or Rainbow Push, those existed for a reason and they've made a difference, or the National Council of La Raza, right? And so now what you're seeing is now some new energy, new organizers and activists. The way that I like to think about it, there's a bus that we're all trying to get on to move towards this kind of ideal of what this country should look like. And we all have a seat on the bus, and it's not all going to look the same, right? We all have a different role. And there's this new energy from some of these younger youth activists and organizers that are saying, listen, we can't necessarily wait. We have to kind of spur some action, and we want this coming from the ground. We want solutions that we know in our country, in our community, can happen if we're pushing them. And that has been great for policymakers. It's been great for activists and organizers because it's forced us to think about, okay, how are we responding to the real needs and the passions and the pain of people who are living this life and this existence every day? And so I think we've never seen kind of maybe the organizing that we've seen online before. So it's taken a different, we didn't have these social media platforms in the same way we do. But the same energy and the organizing, that has been a bedrock of the principle of the movement from time immemorial. Any effective movement has to have organizing. We're just seeing it manifested in a different way with new energy and some new engagement.
And we recently saw a great act of civil disobedience by Bree Newsom just climbing up the pole at the flagpole at the state capitol in South Carolina, just taking down the flag and really making the state legislator, I guess, put some fire under them to act faster because they put it back up, which is a decision that they had to make.
Right. And it was like hashtag Black women are magic. You know, free Bree Newsom. I've now seen some pictures of her depicted as a superhero. But in some ways, in the imagination of, I think, Black people and particularly Black women, seeing her kind of take down the symbol of oppression was a powerful symbolic moment. And now what we all have to do is, now that we're thinking about that symbol, we also have to think about what are some of the institutional and structural issues that flag represented. And we can't shy away from that. Like, that's our part in the superhero movement, right? We have to look at what are the structural and institutional issues that are the epitome of that flag. And if we can deal with that, then we would have won.
Our guest is my friend and colleague, Michelle Jawando. Thank you so much for joining
Thank
us.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. And with me to talk about how disability fits into civil rights is Rebecca Coakley. She's the executive director of the National Council on Disability. Thanks for joining us, Rebecca.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. I'm thrilled to be here.
So tell us a little bit about you. I mean, you've been at NCD for a while, but you've got a rich history of the kinds of work that you've done.
I've been at the National Council on Disability as the executive director for about 2.5 years now. Prior to that, I had a stint over at the Administration for Community Living, which was phenomenal. I got to work with Kathy Greenlee and Henry Claypool and those folks. Prior to that, I spent over 2 years at the White House as the director of Priority Placement for Public Engagement. So I was responsible for outreach and recruitment of all of our diversity groups for roles in the administration. So I was responsible for engaging with race, ethnic, religious minorities, people with disabilities, the LGBT community, women, veterans, and recent college graduates. But I've worked in sort of the broad civil rights space for most of my life. Both my parents are little people, unlike most people with disabilities. I grew up with a sense of disability as already part of diversity from birth. My mom was a disabled students counselor, and so growing up in San Francisco during the height of the AIDS crisis, she lost a number of her students. And many times we ended up being the only people at their funerals, because to my parents, it was important that somebody was there. And so growing up with a sense of how disability sort of fit into both, you know, the LGBT community and even the broader civil rights work. My dad was the son of a federal judge in Alabama who was responsible for throwing multiple freedom riders in jail. There are multiple pages about my paternal grandfather in Congressman Lewis's autobiography, and we joke about it frequently when we run into each other. But my parents really did have that core value of injustice anywhere calls for justice everywhere, and really raised me with that. And so growing up in the Bay Area, being engaged in disability rights from birth, now being in a mixed race marriage, raising two African-American kids with disabilities, being able to really drive a civil rights agenda and narrative within the work at the council, and then also be able to drive a disability rights narrative within the broader dialogue of civil rights is easily the favorite thing that I do.
And people often think, I think, about civil rights as being about race, right? And that's sort of that's where your brain goes when you hear the phrase civil rights movement. You describe the two movements, disability rights and civil rights, as being interdependent, but do you see them as overlapping or related?
I think they definitely overlap. I mean, I think when you're looking at issues of students of color in special education and in the juvenile justice system, there is significant overlap. When you're looking at issues of immigration and detention, a large number of people in detention for immigration issues are people with disabilities. When you look at the issues of poverty and homelessness, disability definitely comes in. When you look at veterans issues, disability comes in. When you look at women's issues, women are more likely to be caregivers with disabilities, caring for an elder parent or a child. And so disability really fundamentally runs through all of these movements.
We've seen over the years the progressive movement bring in racial justice, LGBT justice, as sort of core to the progressive movement. Those are issues that even if you are not a person of color, even if you do not identify as LGBT, those are still issues you care about, much as, you know, climate change has sort of become a core progressive value. How do we get to the point where disability is there? I mean, we have 1 in 5 Americans live with a disability, so it's not like it's some, you know, tiny minority that we're talking about. How do we get to a point where it's a core progressive value and issue?
I think there's a couple of different ways to approach it. One, I think it's sort of an inside-outside game to a certain extent. I think one way is our community has to reflect those communities. We have to be serious and deliberate about developing disabled leaders of color who are members of the NAACP, the National Action Network, the National Congress of Negro Women, the National Council of La Raza. We have to develop disability leaders who are LGBTQIA. And we have to support those parts of their identity. And we have to see that reflected in our leadership. We have to see that reflected in our conferences. And we have to see that integrated in our rhetoric, in the language that we use, when we talk about inclusion, when we talk about what our community looks like. The other piece of it, and I go back to what my colleague Talila Lewis says, and what Kaite Davidson used to say, which is we spend a lot of time worrying about finding allies and not enough about creating allies. And so I think there is something to that. When I think about people that I've worked with over the years, relationships I've developed, colleagues I've done some really neat things with, who may have had nothing to do with disability, but they knew somebody who had a disability, or they had had a hip replacement, or, you know, they went to school with someone, or they had a teacher who was deaf, or they had some tangible connection, or we were even able to approach it from the case of, okay, you know, you're really active in the trans rights community, and saying, okay, let's talk about disability and trans, and talk about sort of the growing fights that both of our movements have had and where there's overlap and where there's intersectionality. And I think part of the challenge is not being afraid. You know, you brought up the environmental movement, and I think that's a good case to look at. I think so many times people see, you know, preservation as anti-ADA, or, you know, discussions of, you know, new technology that the disability community wants leading to more pollution or whatever the case may be, rather than focusing on places where it works. And I think a great example of that is our colleagues in Chicago at Access Living have built easily one of the top independent living centers in the country. And it's also one of Chicago's biggest green buildings. And I think looking at finding those intersections, in that case, the intersection of green design and universal design in architecture, and highlighting those things as examples of where it works. You know, I think also for us, it's being able to have those allies that understand that disability is not a bad thing. I had a conversation with some folks this last week talking about disproportionality of students of color in special education. And yes, that's a huge issue. But at the same time, if we say, okay, we're going to, you know, let's just say we X'd out any students of color in special education, what happens to those students that need the services? And so I think having that conversation that about disability in the context of rights. Your son has a learning disability. Your son is autistic. Your daughter is autistic. You know, there's very little data about girls of color with autism. Okay, your daughter is African-American or Latina and autistic. You're afraid of them going into special education because of the further stigmatization. But let's look at the services. Let's look at IDEA from the context of these are the things that we can use to help set your child up for success. And it will help them in the long run. It will help them be successful in the long run. No parent is going to say no to that. But if you say, if you talk about special education as a place, oh, we're taking your kid out, we're segregating your child and putting them over there, no parent, I wouldn't sign off on that as a parent. And so sometimes how we frame the issues from a rights basis versus a stigma perspective, I think is a real opportunity. But I think that there's always the challenge that these movements face in addressing disability and decentering the conversation, whether it be on race, on ethnicity, on religion, on gender, because they don't want to dilute the message. But we see it as how can disability add further lens, add further perspective, and bring more people to the collective table to talk about the issues groups are facing.
An issue that has really sort of surfaced as the modern day civil rights battle that we're fighting is criminal justice reform. And we're actually seeing a lot of bipartisan momentum around the need for criminal justice reform, although people are coming at it from different places. Does disability have a place here? And is that something that you're working on?
Oh, definitely. It's something that I can say my team and I over at the National Council on Disability and a number of colleagues in the disability community are engaged in. And I have to say it's very exciting because disability is at the table with the broader civil rights groups. We've been working with groups like the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, Leadership Conference, and other organizations that are pushing broad-based criminal justice and police reform. And it's been exciting to see disability not be segregated to the short bus in this conversation, as our issues tend to be. And I think part of it has been because we've been able to come to the table with a value add. You know, for example, we know that in New Mexico, 75% of police shootings have been, the victims have been people with mental health disabilities.
75%.
75% in the state of New Mexico. You know, as we have conversations about the data collection piece, I think disability really comes into it. We don't have good data on disability and police violence. And even in the Death in Custody Act, in the last reauthorization, disability wasn't included as one of those categories, which we definitely would like to see in any sort of potential reauthorization or amendment. But a tie to that, too, I mean, I think it would be really important and really critical to look at disabilities that have occurred or that somebody has acquired while in police custody, you know, to look at sort of the Freddie Gray case. As an example, you know, how many disabilities are acquired while somebody is in custody from the time that they're arrested through processing, et cetera. I think, you know, looking at Ferguson specifically, we've heard a number of times from people with disabilities who are down there in that area. Activists like Heather Damian and others who, you know, Heather, for example, was removed from her wheelchair and she had GoPros mounted to her chair and police removed her from her chair. And the other protesters got engaged and were very upset about it because Heather's been there since day one as a resident of the area filming what's been going on. And I think as we have these conversations, people continue to point to CIT training, crisis intervention training, as the answer. But as we look at CIT training, it only specifically typically looks at mental health and intellectual and maybe intellectual and developmental disabilities. It's not a solution. 8 hours of training does not teach every law enforcement officer how to approach any person with any type of disability. These issues are not specific just to mental health and IDDD, but more broadly, you know, we have cases of people who have seizure disorders, having a seizure in the car and getting shot by cops. You know, we had somebody who was tased repeatedly who was, I believe they were deaf and the car ran over them. Or even the case actually in Fairfax County a couple of weeks ago where it came out that Fairfax County police had arrested a gentleman, a Nigerian immigrant who was deaf, who was in police custody for 6 weeks for supposedly stealing an iPad at National Airport, which they later found and recovered that he had and learned that he hadn't stolen it. But he was in jail for 6 weeks without a sign language interpreter. 6 weeks without being able to ask for your basic human needs because they're denying you reasonable accommodations. And so I think there really is a disability voice in this conversation. And, you know, and as I remind my allies frequently in the disability community, it is critical while our voice is there that we center the conversation. We don't decentralize the Black Lives Matter conversation. This is not an All Lives Matter conversation, or Black Lives Matter and Disability Lives Matter too. Rather, in the context of Black Lives Matter, not losing sight that within Black Lives Matter, there are Black people with disabilities that are running into these incidents over and over again. And we need to be addressing these issues. And as we address them, we'll see overall improvement for the entire community.
So we're also celebrating a major anniversary for the Americans with Disabilities Act this year, the ADA. There's often discussion about a so-called ADA generation. And I think you technically would be part of the ADA generation. Mm-hmm. You are not a pale, stale male dude in a wheelchair. Can you talk a little bit about what the future of the US looks like?
Definitely. You know, the term ADA generation was something we actually coined years ago to really be able to differentiate and to really point out what happens when you have IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which actually turns 40 this fall, intersect with the ADA. So you have young people with disabilities who ideally have been included in K-12 public education, you know, receiving free and appropriate public education in the least restrictive environment, engaging with their peers. I think it fundamentally shapes the diversity of our country. I think when you think about how prior to IDEA, when you would look across a classroom, you know, prior to IDEA and post Brown v. Board, you saw one type of diversity enter the classroom. However, if you talk to most folks our age in their, you know, mid-30s and younger, they have no memory of a time when students with disabilities were not in public schools. And so that shapes the brain. That shapes how people think about diversity. They don't remember a time when Linda the librarian was not on Sesame Street as one of the most widely known disabled characters. Kids or teenagers today, because I don't let my kids watch it, even though they should, are not going to remember a time pre-Peter Dinklage mm-hmm. being on television mm-hmm. and what the portrayal of Tyrion Lannister has meant. My husband refers to Tyrion Lannister as the modern Sidney Poitier, as the modern role of Mr. Tibbs to a certain effect.
And you're talking, of course, about the popular show Game of Thrones.
Yes, I'm talking about Game of Thrones. And I think when we talk about the future of our movement and what that means, it means young people that are graduating today with the expectation of employment. Young people that are graduating today and saying, you know, yeah, like all other college kids, I may go live bunk at home for a year and a half after I graduate, but that doesn't mean I can't go get a job. I think there's also an ongoing conversation, as there is any time there is a war, about attention to veterans issues and veterans with disabilities. I was talking to a colleague who runs an internship program for interns with disabilities recently, and he said, well, you know, over here at the VA, our folks are going to be hesitant because it's got the word disability in there. And to me, that's sad. To me, when I hear that people use terms like special needs or handicapable or differently abled, it's sad and it's frustrating. Both because it's very paternalistic, but also it disconnects people from their civil rights. Nowhere in IDEA, ADA, or any other piece of disability public policy will you see the word special needs. Will you see handicapable? Those words were created by non-disabled people to make them feel better about disability. And so when I claim disability, I claim it like the armor I wear. I claim disability as an act, as a political action, as an act of claiming my civil rights. And so as we see people with disabilities, particularly young people with disabilities, make the fight to claim that, it really is a political action. And we're a growing politicized community in a lot of ways, I think. It'll be interesting to see over the next several years where this community moves and what it really deems its priorities, because they're not just seeing disability issues only as their concern. They're also people of color. They're also people who are LGBTQIA. They don't see their identity as a hat that they switch off, that before, whether it was the movement forcing them, their family sort of forcing them, or their own feeling like they could only wear one identity at a time, we're really seeing a shift in that direction. And I think that also leads to the broader conversation on disability rights as part of civil rights.
Rebecca Coakley, Executive Director of the National Council on Disability. We could talk for hours.
Oh, definitely.
I wish we had the entire episode for this, but I guess that just means we'll have to have you back.
Definitely, I'd love it.
Thanks so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. And with me is Katie Klobusik. She's a writer and a reproductive justice activist. If you're like me, you follow her on Twitter at Katie_speak. Katie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Katie, I wanted to talk with you as part of our civil rights episode about how reproductive justice fits in with this larger civil rights frame. And to kick us off, would you mind reading a little bit from one of your first essays, which you wrote for your blog about your own personal story?
Sure. It's nice being asked to read this. It's like a flashback. It was the first thing I'd written in over 10 years, so I still have a little affection for it. I'm talking about how I ended up needing to terminate a pregnancy. It's time to get honest about the word choice. $80 per month, that's the cost of my birth control through the health insurance I pay for out of pocket. With two jobs, that's relatively doable. After losing three jobs in less than a year, however, that $80 started to look like bread and potatoes and orange juice. I like bread and potatoes and orange juice. I decided I'd chance the return of monthly migraines in order to eat. I remember clearly what it's like to be hungry, and not being fond of it, I made a choice.
So, I mean, tell us a little bit about your own story from there. What happened after you made that choice?
Sure. So I was still seeing someone that I had dated for almost 4 years. And like a lot of couples, since I'd been on birth control the entire time that we knew each other, there wasn't that like automatic pause, reach for protection moment in our routine, because we had never needed to do that. Or at least it had been years since we had needed to do that. And so when I stopped using the birth control, the generic pill had stopped working for me. It wasn't controlling the migraines. So I was using NuvaRing, which is a name brand, and therefore my prescription plan that I paid for, was legal before the Affordable Care Act for my insurance company to just not cover it. So, I lost my third job in under a year in 2010 and the end of 2009, 2010. And like a lot of people who've struggled with long-term poverty and food insecurity, the second something like that happens, you start immediately like taking anything that's not completely necessary out of your budget. A dollar that doesn't have to be spent doesn't get spent. And really the only place I could cut was my birth control. I spent a lot of years grocery shopping at the dollar store. I can grocery shop on $80. So for 4 or 5 months, I wasn't on birth control. And I, of course, didn't bother to mention it. And he didn't ask because it'd never been an issue, right? We'd had that discussion years earlier. So literally the next morning I woke up and I was like, crap. Like that's when it occurred to me that I wasn't on anything and we didn't use anything. And so then I had to wait around for a home pregnancy test to be accurate. And, you know, my story is luckier than most. Because I had decent health insurance for the time, I had my own OBGYN. I was on the HPV abnormal PAP merry-go-round. So I'd actually spent a fair amount of time in my doctor's office for someone who was just 30. And so I had a safe place to go and talk about it and have the test. And we did the transvaginal ultrasound to make sure that we knew what was going on. And then we talked about my options. And I, although my doctor at the time didn't perform abortions, he was really, like, he was very generous about it. And his question about how did this happen wasn't accusatory. It was just, I've prescribed you birth control. Is your birth control failing? Like, let's talk about this. I know you don't want children. And so I ended up going to Planned Parenthood instead, simply because my insurance didn't cover it. And I discovered that if you have the maternity rider, it'll cover an elective abortion, which for anyone who's ever had maternity insurance, you know how prohibitively expensive that is. So I can't imagine electing to terminate a pregnancy if you're paying for maternity coverage. So ridiculous. So, I mean, my experience was relatively simple. There's a Planned Parenthood literally down the block. And, you know, it was like $400-something for the procedure, which I just put on a credit card. And I had two female managers at my two jobs. So getting off work was no problem. I had coworkers to cover my shift. But even with that, it was unpaid time off. So the cost of my abortion, even though I didn't have to travel and access it at like 6 weeks, was about $1,000. And this was before trap laws. This was in Chicago, where your clinic might be picketed
but there's a clinic, right? And so I think a lot about, especially now when we're seeing a lot of attacks on specifically shaming people who need things like food assistance, and the Hyde Amendment will likely get added to the budget again. I think about my story and how frustrating it was for me and how awful it was to be pregnant when I didn't want to be pregnant. And imagine what people who don't have such easy access must be going through emotionally. And that's the state now. That's the state of abortion access in this country. We have almost 90% of counties don't have a provider. So, you know, my story is pretty boring compared to what most patients are going through.
Well, and you make the point in that same essay that you are one in three American women. This is not some, out of the norm story, but rather that one in three women will have an abortion in her lifetime. Is that why you felt the need to share your story?
No, actually, I didn't know that stat at the time. I was a dog walking bartender who spent 10 years working 70, 80, 90, 100 hours a week, is not an exaggeration, trying to make ends meet. And so I cared about politics, and I canvassed for the president in my hometown in Indiana in 2007. But I didn't really have, like a lot of poor people who work a lot, I didn't have a lot of time to engage. So I didn't know that stat. I just frustratedly missed writing. I'd missed doing something with my life and my time that made a difference. And so I wanted to start writing again. And I just hadn't, you know, after 10 years, what do you write about? Well, I was getting ready for work one morning and I heard a clip of Dana Loesch when Susan G. Komen pulled their funding from Planned Parenthood, that tiff they had in early 2012. And I heard her saying that everyone should support Komen because liberals only care about breast cancer when they can push their pro-abortion agenda, because abortion is liberal birth control. And it just struck me. I was like, that's not my experience. That's not what happened with me. Like I accidentally got pregnant and didn't want to be pregnant. Like that was the beginning and end of my story. It was very simple. That wasn't, you know, I'd been on birth control for years. I was like, she's not allowed the last word. That's ridiculous. So I called into a national radio show I used to listen to and realized by the time I hung up that I'd pretty much outed myself on national radio, so I might as well write about it. And when I was looking for a way to talk about it, I was like, well, how many of us are there? And it's really four in 10. You know, there's typically a little over a million abortions every year, most of which are very early, most of which are women in their early to mid-20s. Very much to my circumstance, 70% are, you know, on the lower income side. So, you know, this is how it happens, right? People who have to choose between birth control and food and other bills. I mean, we're still human, and that's, you know, that's just how it happens a lot, like the majority of the time.
And we've seen restrictions that really kind of throw up hurdles to reproductive access emerge in Texas and in many conservative states across the country. What's going on in terms of abortion rights? Bring us up to speed on sort of the landscape and why that matters.
Sure. There's a famous assault on abortion access that started in 2010 with the Tea Party wave. But people should know this is a concerted effort, long-term effort by the far right, by the far conservative. I call them usually the faux religious right. There are a lot of really amazing faith-based reproductive justice organizations, Faith Aloud and the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice, that are really amazing. But the folks that tend to twist, you know, cherry pick and twist religion or other things also do it with abortion. And the second Roe was decided. You know, this has been going on since then. They've been working long term to get judges, you know, friendly judges on the lower courts and then the circuit courts and then the Supreme Court. And they do the same thing with legislators and officials, and they fund them, and they have long term plans. My friend Lee Camp likes to say that evil people have plans. And that's true. And I, you know, nice, nice, caring people just going about their lives, and the evil people are like off in an office with, you know, PowerPoints and wipe off boards, like planning on how to make other people's lives worse. And so while the second wave feminism thought that we'd won, mostly because we were not listening to women of color, who could have told us, you know, 40 years ago that if we didn't do some culture change, that Roe wasn't going to necessarily help us forever, because it's not an affirmative right to abortion. It just prohibits states from limiting access to a certain point. And so, you know, here we are years later, and every state except I think it's Oregon, since Roe, has passed some sort of restriction. You know, self-inducing abortion is illegal in every state. The Hyde Amendment that will very likely get passed again, that's attached to the budget, prevents people who use Medicaid as their insurer from using their insurance to terminate a pregnancy. And, you know, that's been going on since 1976. I mean, that's a federal law. So there are states that are better than others, but there aren't really any great states. You know, I live in California, but I think it's something like 45% of counties don't have an abortion provider. Crisis pregnancy centers, fake clinics outnumber abortion providers 2-1 here. And that landscape has happened over time, very gradually, when, you know, nice, good people weren't paying attention. And now we're paying attention. So now we have to do something about it. What's going on in Texas is particularly alarming, not just because I have a lot of friends there and have spent a lot of time there, but because the Fifth Circuit that oversees Texas and Mississippi, so Mississippi that famously just has the one clinic, there's been the fight to keep that open / close it, keep it open, close it, and all the talk about undue burden, how far is too far, is only one clinic in a state an undue burden, or if they can hop over a border that's close by to a clinic, is that fine? That sort of decision was decided by the Fifth Circuit as that, listen, one clinic, you have to have a clinic in a state, you can't close that clinic. Well, the Fifth Circuit is very conservative and very ideologically driven, and they have very specifically decided this recent court case that happened the beginning of June to sort of muddy the waters. Jessica Mason Pico has got a great piece at RH Reality Check that sort of explains it better than I do on how they've created their own conflict. And it's conflicts in the circuit courts that send things to the Supreme Court.
And do you see attacks on reproductive rights as having a civil rights dimension?
Of course. Really, when it comes down to it, if you can't control what's happening in your own body, and you can't control your reproductive capability, and this also has to do with whether being able to have children when you want to, right? That's part of reproductive justice, is that you should be able to parent when you want to parent. You should be able to safely parent without worrying that your son or daughter is going to get, you know, shot walking down the street. And if you can't control if and how you're going to become a parent, you can't control any other part of your life. That's your entire life, and you can't make any other decision. So if you take away basic access to things like, I mean, even birth control, you know, I'm certainly abortion on demand. I would like to see abortion on demand publicly funded, along with all other healthcare under a single payer system. But in Texas, some of the clinics that they're closing don't even provide abortions. So now you have the places where people went for annual exams, you know, cervical cancer screenings and birth control. It's creating a public health crisis all in the name of life. And we don't seem to value the autonomy and the life of the already living, breathing person. We seem to value potential life in those spaces, but we don't value the actual life that's here. So certainly it's a cross-section with economic justice and civil rights.
Who is most affected by restrictions on abortion access?
Oh, sure. Low-income people and people of color, right? The folks that continually get traded away for political capital. And it happens over and over and over again. I mean, that's what happens with Hyde every day. The Hyde Amendment affects 1 in 5 patients who would seek to terminate a pregnancy who have who have Medicaid as their insurance end up carrying a pregnancy to term because they can't afford the abortion. And that affects that person, that family, that community. You know, it's a compounding issue. But we don't see the value in investing either in people or in basic healthcare.
My guest is Katie Klobusek. She's a writer and a reproductive justice activist. You can find her on Twitter at Katie_speak. Katie, thank you so much for sharing your story and for coming on to Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. We'll be back next week, Thursday at 4, also available on iTunes as a podcast, or you can listen online at weactradio.com. Special thanks to our executive producers, Alyssa Peterson and the one and only Greg Kaufman, CAP's amazing poverty and press teams.
And as always, DC's own Chris Stiles Bacon gets the last word. Thanks for listening.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring in the dough. And none of those could connect me with the HMO. And nowadays it's common for grandparents to outlive their grandkids. And those are the type of odds that we handling. I'm not a slave to a man with a whip. I'm a slave to the U.S. men. And it got me doing things in my life that never made any sense. But it paid me in dollars and cents. I need the money for the food, the health care, the schools and bus fare. You can't pay the rent without the U.S. right there. With shackles on my hands and toes, they got a brother moving slow, but my soul is determined to go. I want freedom, freedom. Now I don't know where it's at, but it's calling me back. I feel my spirit is revealing the map. We just trying to get freedom. What we talking about?